Welcome to the Whole Psychiatry Hour on WMET 1160 with your host, Dr. Bob Hedaya. Sit back, relax, listen, and learn about a unique approach to mental health. And now, here's your host of the Whole Psychiatry Hour, Dr. Bob Hedaya.
Welcome, folks. It's great to be with you this morning on the Whole Psychiatry Hour on Talk Radio WMET 1160. It's really my pleasure to be with you today. I'm Dr. Bob Hedaya, your host on the Whole Psychiatry Hour. We're here every Sunday at 11 a.m. That's 1160 at 11. I am a psychiatrist and a psychopharmacologist. I am in private practice in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and I'm a professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University Hospital. On this show every week, my goal is to broaden your concept of mental health and to break the standard mindset that says the only way of achieving mental health is through medication or psychotherapy or some combination of the two. It's very clear to me from the research and the literature that there are many avenues and many contributors to mental health, and I want you to learn about those things each week. The goal is for you to learn to take responsibility for your mental health and to begin to understand the connection between the mind and the immune system, the hormones, the genetics, the liver, the diet, the culture, places we live in, spirituality, trauma. Today we're going to be talking about trauma. All of these things have an impact on your mental health. I was reminded this week about another factor that can have an effect on your mental health. And I'm treating a family, actually, three people in a family, for a diversity of mental health problems from agitation, irritability, depression, ADD. And it turns out this week we discovered that there are pesticides in the well water that this family is drinking. And this family has been living in their home for 14 years. They live on a farm, and the farm next to them is pretty active, and apparently pesticides have been seeping into the well water and are having an effect on their mental function, and it shows up in a diversity of ways. But again, this is another example of how you have to be a detective to get to the underlying causes of mental illness and mental health problems. So each week, we will explore different facets of mental health. This week, we're going to be talking about childhood stress and childhood trauma with Dr. Russell T. Jones, a clinical psychologist. Dr. Jones will help us understand what stress is for children, what kind of things stress them, and how they respond to these stresses, and what we as parents or educators can do to help these children. Dr. Jones is a professor of psychology, as I mentioned, and he also specializes in community psychology, and he is also a member of the editorial board of several well-known journals. Dr. Jones is a fellow of the American Psychological Association and has been a member of the board for the advancement of psychology in the public interest. He's very distinguished, and so I'd like to welcome Dr. Jones to the Whole Psychiatry Hour. Dr. Jones, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Jones, could you tell us what drew you to this field to begin with?
Yes, I've always been interested in children and how children function under stress. My initial work started back in 1976 while doing an internship at Brown University. And one of my rotations there was a Head Start Center. And I was interested in continuing my research that I had done at Penn State and had asked the director if, in fact, I could do that in the area of self-regulatory functioning. Well, I was told that since this was an inner-city school, I could not do that. But the director then said that there's a teacher that might have a problem, who has a problem, rather, that you might be able to help her with. So I went down and I talked with the teacher, and she informed me that two children had recently perished in nighttime residential fires. And I was asked if I knew anything about helping kids what to do with fires, and at that point started a program of research teaching children how to function in emergency situations, teaching children emergency dialing, teaching children techniques such as fire evacuation skills, and not only teaching those skills, but also ensuring the maintenance as well as the generalization of those skills in children. Subsequent to that time, we then started looking at the clinical impact of residential fires, hurricanes, and that kind of thing on children. And in 1996, me and a colleague actually received a grant from the National Institutes of Mental Health to study the impact of residential fire on children. So there we were looking at the clinical as well as the psychosocial implications of residential fire on children and their parents. And we're continuing to do a good bit of that research today. And I have also designed a program to help children and their parents recover from residential fire.
Wow, that's a lot. So it's been a long process for you.
Indeed.
Can we start? We have a couple of minutes or so just before the break, but can we define stress, say childhood stress for the audience?
Sure. And in fact, let me actually define post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a very common response of many individuals who are involved in traumatic events. Now, I should qualify that by saying that not everyone meets the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, but many individuals do, in fact, report symptoms. And what it is, it's a an individual has to be exposed to a traumatic event where the person he either experiences the event or witnesses the event or is confronted with an event that involves the actual threat of death or serious injury.
Does the nature of the threat have an impact? In other words, if you're exposed to fire as opposed to gunshots say a theft, does the nature of the stress change the reaction?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and it really depends on an individual's perception. But it has shown, it has been found in research, and in fact, some of our own research, that fires can in fact lead to post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as gunshots. Car accidents. Many of the children that have undergone Hurricane Katrina will, in fact, show signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, will report symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt. This is the Whole Psychiatry Hour on WMET 1160. We're talking with Dr. Russell Jones, clinical psychologist, about childhood stress. We'll be back shortly.
WMET, Washington.
If getting life insurance is on your things to do list, now you can get a term life policy in just 10 minutes. 10 minutes to get up to $150,000 of term life insurance if you qualify through Jefferson National Life Insurance Company. Call now for a free quote, 1-866-612-3600. With Jefferson National, there's no medical exam, no long forms, and no agent will visit you. Just complete a short application over the phone. If you qualify, your coverage starts right away. That's instant term life coverage in one simple call. Call Jefferson National at 1-866-612-3600. Getting life insurance has never been easier to cross off your list. Contains limitations. Based in Dallas, Texas, Jefferson National issues term life under form number JNLSEL03 or a state variation. Call Jefferson National now. 1-866-612-3600. That's 1-866-612-3600.
Attention men and women suffering from hair loss. Now, with Avacor, a world leader in hair regrowth, you don't have to be bald, even if you have a family history of hair loss. Here's Dr. Mark Goodman, board-certified dermatologist.
The main reason for thinning hair and baldness is hereditary hair loss. Just because there is a family history of hair loss doesn't mean you have to suffer. Avacor is specially formulated to reverse hereditary hair loss and regrow new healthy hair. Our formula targets the hair follicle to effectively stop hair loss and stimulate new hair growth. Before you consider expensive transplant surgery, remember, Avacor is FDA approved to regrow new healthy hair for men and women.
We're giving away a free month of Avacor with all of today's orders. Call 800-449-8917. That's 800-449-8917. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. Call 800-449-8917. That's 800-449-8917.
You put your keys between your knuckles. Someone approaches you and you cross to the other side of the street. You lock the door behind you, maybe twice. Now you feel safe. You think you've made the right choices to protect yourself. Think again. Because if you're not eating right, if you're not active, or if you smoke, you're putting yourself at risk for disease. Learn to protect yourself from yourself at everydaychoices.org. A message from the American Cancer Society, American Diabetes Association, American Heart Association, and the Ad Council.
Talk Radio, WMET 1160, is your station for intelligent talk and a little bit of wackiness. Greaseman gets you started in the morning at 6, followed by Tony Snow at 9, J.T. Ballard at noon, G. Gordon Liddy at 2, Linda Chavez on your drive home, the Bauer and Rose Show in the evenings, and Alan Combs Late Nights. Your station, for talk. WMET 1160 and online at WMET1160.com.
You're tuned to the Whole Psychiatry Hour on WMET 1160. Here once again is your host, Dr. Bob Hedaya.
Welcome back to the Whole Psychiatry at WMET Talk Radio 1160. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Hedaya, and we're talking today with Dr. Russell T. Jones, a distinguished psychologist, about childhood stress and, more specifically at this point, post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Jones, we started out talking about the uncontrollable, threatening nature of a stimulus, something that might threaten a child, and how that leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. What are the other symptoms that a parent can look for, or an educator can look for, that would tip them off?
Okay, yeah, excellent question. Two things that I think are very important is that the person, in terms of actually experiencing the distress, there needs to be an intense fear and helplessness or horror that the individual feels. So whatever the event is, there needs to be that sense of fear, helplessness, or horror. That's very important. Now, in terms of the actual clusters, there are what we call three different clusters of symptoms that a child or an adult are likely to experience or would experience if, in fact, they meet the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. The first set of symptoms are called they're persistent re-experiencing the event.
Or like flashbacks.
Yes, sure, flashbacks. So flashbacks are one of the symptoms within that cluster. Another symptom would be frightening dreams. Another would be feeling that the event is recurring over and over again.
You mean they fear that it's going to occur over and over again, or it actually is occurring?
They perceive it occurring over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
We call these intrusive thoughts, and mm-hmm. the reason we call them intrusive thoughts is because you can't stop the thoughts from coming.
And I guess the children maybe have a little more difficulty distinguishing the reality from the flashback.
Yeah, many times that is the case because we know children, particularly young children, don't have the coping wherewithal that adolescents and adults do. So in children, this particular disorder and these symptoms can be particularly distressing and disheartening.
We're talking with Dr. Russell T. Jones, clinical psychologist, about trauma in children. Dr. Jones, what are the most common traumatic events that children experience, and are these events different depending on the socioeconomic status of the child?
Well, there are a number of events that can actually trigger post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And again, they can be anything from natural disasters as well as technological disasters. Natural disasters, we're talking about things like the tsunami, for example, or floods or hurricanes or wildfires. Technological disasters, or another name for that is man-made disasters.
Does that include my cell phone breaking?
That could be. But I think we're typically talking about something a little bit more
serious.
Dramatic.
Yeah.
And this can be things like car accidents. It can be fighting. It can be a host of other things.
Would fighting between parents be included in that, or you're talking about a political or war?
No, certainly war. We do know that children that are exposed to war do, in fact, show elevated levels of symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. But it can also come from fighting within the home. We know that another cause of post-traumatic stress disorder is abuse. And in fact, there's been research that's actually shown that children that are abused over extended periods of time have an increased likelihood of not only post-traumatic stress disorder, but also depression. Mm-hmm. I think a related finding with respect to children that have been abused, there's some data to suggest that not only are children impacted psychologically, but they're also impacted neurobiologically. And what I mean by that is that there's some data to suggest that there's some dysregulation of important chemicals in the brain, such as cortisol, that has been found to have quite a negative impact on individuals' functioning.
Yeah, I've actually researched that a fair amount, and it's been shown, of course, that the cortisol can affect the structures in the brain, like the hippocampus, et cetera.
Indeed. That's not only been shown in animals, but also in humans.
Well, let me ask you this. What makes some children more vulnerable to these stressors, or are we all vulnerable?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Here's what we know, and in fact, this is something that I've had an opportunity to share with several audiences in the Gulf Coast area. It's typically risk factors. What are the risk factors? We know that children and adults who are not doing well prior to a traumatic event, flood, hurricane, or fire, they typically do less well than individuals who have been doing relatively okay prior to the onset of that event. So, for example, children who may suffer from, let's say, attention deficit disorder, depression, children who may have been exposed to previous traumatic events, those kids typically do less well than those that have not been exposed to such such a phenomenon.
Well, so that's sad, because the kids who are most compromised to start are the ones who take the biggest hit, really.
Indeed.
That's pretty disturbing.
Indeed. A couple of other factors that has been shown to negatively predispose children to post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as depression and other disorders, is the family. Those children who seem to come from more intact families, families where there is, let's say, less chaos, less fighting, etc., seem to do better than those that don't come from those homes. So I'm saying the more well-adjusted families, if you will, children seem to do better than those that don't. We also know that there are other factors, such as race, socioeconomic status, that seems to have an impact on how well children do following traumatic events.
How do those things affect a person's response to stress?
Well, in fact, some of our research has shown that children that undergo residential fires, we found that the African-American adolescents seem to do less well, and let me qualify that, seem to show more distress than did Caucasian adolescents. And
even if they're from the same socioeconomic status?
Yes.
How do you explain that? Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was just going to qualify that. They seem to do less well than did the Caucasian counterparts, as well as Caucasian and African-American children.
So what's the explanation for that?
Well, that's a very good question. We don't know the full answer yet, but we think it has something to do with the loss of community. Oftentimes, children who are involved in major fires not only lose their home, but they're also forced to relocate. And there's been some very interesting research published by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta that suggests that children who are dislocated on numerous occasions are at greater risk for depression, suicide, as well as a number of psychological disorders. So we know that moving, being forced to move on repeated occasions, do in fact increase the risk of individuals not doing well.
Just coming from an instability, really.
Sure.
Is what you're saying. Now, I know that you were recently with the First Lady in Louisiana, and I want to get to that, but I would really like to ask you, I have never been exposed to a fire myself, and I wonder, what is it like for a child to be exposed to a fire in their home?
Yeah, a number of kids, unfortunately, this topic has not been researched extensively, and we're very grateful to the National Institutes of Mental Health, who's funded that research, a good part of that research. Children tell us, many children tell us, it's the most distressing or the most frightening experience that they've ever had. Many children also tell us is that they are very fearful of a second fire. And in fact, what a number of children have told us is that I was lucky the first time, but next time I'm going to actually die in the fire. So it's not only the fact that, you know, they're experiencing this horrific event, but there's the fear that's deeply embedded that it's going to occur again, and they're not going to get out.
I think it points to the issue of control. Does a person have a locus of control? And if they do, they maybe feel more guarded, more safe within themselves. But if there's no locus of control, if this fire just comes for no apparent reason and they just got out really in a very fortunate, fortuitous way, they don't feel that sense of control. And so the anxiety level is high all the time.
Exactly. And that's not unique to fire. And in fact, one of the things that we've done in this fire work, we've actually started a program, and we call it REACT, and that's Recovery Efforts After Child Trauma. And what we're trying to do is to teach children who have been involved in residential fires what to do in the event of a second fire. So we teach them emergency dialing, for example. We teach them fire evacuation skills. We have them develop a plan with their family, practice that plan, et cetera. And we think that that gives them a greater sense of control or a greater sense of self-efficacy, if you will, that if this thing were to occur again, I would know what to do and therefore not likely to endure any harm.
Now, this seems like a logical and a good thing actually for every family to have in place, but most families don't do this.
Exactly.
Is there some resource that our listeners can go to if they want to access this, some kind of a structured program, something they can teach their children? It might take 15, 20 minutes.
Sure, sure. We have that information available. They could go to our email address. It's react@vforvirginiatfortech.edu.
Okay, that's great.
And there are also other websites. The National Fire Protection Association has a wonderful website with information talking about children and fire.
Okay, great. We're talking with Dr. Russell T. Jones here on WMET 1160 AM about childhood trauma. What was your assessment of children who were impacted from disasters such as wildfires in Santa Barbara, Hurricane Andrew, or even most recently Hurricane Katrina?
Okay, very good question. Let me go with the fires first. Given that we've not actually, there's very little data collected on Katrina, although there are some, I think, some very good working hypotheses in terms of what's going to take place. Going back to fire, in our NIMH data, we found that in our first 100 children, that approximately 7% developed post-traumatic stress disorder, and approximately 9 to 10% developed major depression. And these are children and adolescents between the ages of 8 and 18 years of age. We also found that a very high percentage of the children actually reported elevated levels of distress. So all children were distressed at varying levels. I think about a third reported very high distress as a result of the residential fire. And we think the major contributing factor was loss, that is, loss of your property, loss of your clothing, loss of time, having to move away, loss of friends, loss of community. Many of the things
I'm going to interrupt. Everything is thrown up in the air. We're going to get back in just a short minute or maybe 2 minutes with Dr. Russell T. Jones. We're going to talk about the lifelong consequences of trauma and childhood depression and more. This is WMET 1160, the Whole Psychiatry Hour.
WMET, Washington.
much would you pay for valuable news and information that could help you get ahead in business, invest smarter, increase your income, and lower your taxes? How about 38 cents a day? That's all it costs to get the Wall Street Journal. Imagine 8 weeks free delivery for 50% off the regular subscription rate. Millions of readers rely on the Wall Street Journal for the important business news and in-depth feature reporting they need on investments, taxes, new technologies, marketing strategies, and more. The Wall Street Journal puts it all within your reach. Subscribe now and get 8 weeks of the Wall Street Journal for only 38 cents a day. That's 50% off the regular rate. This limited time offer is available to new subscribers in the continental U.S. only.
Call now, 800-431-7700. That's 800-431-7700 for the Wall Street Journal. Adventures in Capitalism.
It's not too late. All over the country, people are still taking advantage of 3.99% mortgage rates from Quicken Loans. You could cut hundreds off your monthly house payment with a rate of just 3.99% on the Smart Choice interest-only loan. Call Quicken Loans at 800-316-5711 to see how much you can save. For example, with a $200,000 loan, your monthly payment would be just $665. Whether you're purchasing or refinancing, find out about this limited-time offer. The 3.99% Smart Choice Loan, exclusively from Quicken Loans. Call now, 800-316-5711. That's 800-316-5711. 30-year mortgage interest only for the first 10 years. Initial interest rate of 3.99%, APR 6.821%. Adjust every 6 months. After 6 months, interest payment is $1,125. Points required. Quicken Loans is an equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Call now, 800-316-5711.
Hi, this is Joe Perry.
And Steven Tyler of Aerosmith for Red. You know, it's okay to rock and roll and party down. Just don't get in that 2,000-pound bullet when you're done and cocked. And please don't drink and drive.
Someone that jaded you.
A reminder that friends don't let friends drive drunk. A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council, U.S. Department of Transportation, National Association of Broadcasters, and RAD.
The only place in Washington to hear the voices of Fox Radio. Talk Radio, WMET 1160, your station for Tony Snow. Weekday mornings, 9 to noon. Alan Combs, late nights from 10 to 1. Grease Man in the morning. J.D. Ballard at noon. G. Gordon Liddy at 2. Linda Chavez at 4. And Bauer and Rose at 6. Intelligent talk with a splash of grease. Talk Radio, WMET 1160. Online at WMET1160.com.
We're back with the Whole Psychiatry Hour on WMET 1160. Here once again is your host, Dr. Bob Hedaya.
Welcome back to the Whole Psychiatry Hour at WMET Talk Radio 1160. We're talking today with Dr. Russell T. Jones about childhood trauma. Dr. Jones, during the break, you were mentioning another website for our listeners. What was that?
Yes, that's the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And you can Google that, National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And it's a network out of UCLA and Duke University, and it's set up with the sole purpose of helping children who have been exposed to some type of trauma. That trauma can be anything from abuse to a Katrina.
Okay, that's a great resource. Overall, what percent of our children are exposed to some type of trauma in their life?
That's a good question. What percent? I think that all children are exposed to varying levels of trauma. In fact, I have a colleague who wrote a book. It was called The Toxic Environment, and it was by Dr. Garbarino. And the point he was making in that book is that because of environment, the change in environment, and a number of other things, that children are continually exposed to potentially traumatic phenomenon. We certainly know that weather does, in fact, produce a good bit of trauma for children. I mean, we've seen that with the tsunami. We're seeing that with Katrina. We've seen that with wildfires in some of our own work. We've seen that with floods, that kind of thing. So I think most children are exposed to, all children are exposed to varying levels of trauma throughout their lifetime.
Thunderstorms. I remember those.
Yes.
So you were talking before about a fire and the impact it has on a child's life and really, really dismantling their life. Right?
Yes, indeed.
Can you go further with that? Tell us a little more.
Sure. And in fact, in some of our research, we found that that children who we looked at children for over a period of 1 year, and while many children do okay after a period of time, most children don't develop post-traumatic stress disorder nor depression. But those that do, a good percentage of those children continue to experience those symptoms or even get worse over time. So we know that children should be treated if, in fact, they demonstrate elevated levels of symptomatology. And again, that can be post-traumatic stress disorder, that can be depression, that could be some other anxiety disorder. But those children who show elevated levels should, in fact, be seen by a counselor, a school teacher, or some other type of mental health professional.
You know, I'm aware of some of the research that was done on Israeli soldiers, I guess, who were subject to trauma in war. And they followed them over years, 20, 30, 40 years, and they showed a higher incidence of illnesses and a shorter lifespan.
Yeah.
So we're talking about something that doesn't really disappear. Do we know whether treatment, and we'll get to what the treatment might be, but do we know whether treatment can reverse that?
That's a very good question. I don't know if it can actually reverse it. In fact, I've heard several investigators in this area say that that it never goes away. In fact, I've heard a couple of colleagues say that it's trauma is the gift that keeps giving.
Mm.
And what's meant by that is it continues. It continues over a period of time. For example, the children who have experienced Katrina, those children will never forget that experience. They'll never forget that they have, in fact, been in a Katrina type situation. It's very unlikely that they'll forget that experience. Now, hopefully, the trauma or the memories that's paired with that negative event will be lessened over time. One of the goals of treatment is to disconnect the fearful, negative, emotional feelings that go with certain thoughts of what took place. Like, you know, being separated from a parent or seeing the waters or seeing the fire, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when many children experience traumatic events, that event is, there's an image that, or a memory that the child has of that event for an extended period of time.
We're talking with Dr. Russell T. Jones on WMET 1160 about childhood trauma. Dr. Jones, are there resilience factors so that we don't have to look only at how unstable was the child or the family or the community before the trauma? But there are some people who are very resilient to trauma, and is it possible to inculcate those resilience factors in children?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yeah, there's good news, and the good news is that there are indeed resilience factors. There are indeed factors that have been shown to lessen the impact of traumatic events. Two of those are social support, and the other is coping. Let me talk a little bit about each of those. First of all, social support, I mean, that's a very key factor. In fact, it's very difficult to overestimate the impact of social support. And what I mean are parents, siblings, teachers, friends, etc. Those factors have been shown in a number of studies to lessen the negative impact of traumatic experiences on children, adolescents, as well as adults.
So the more well-grounded one is, and the more tied into a community, the more bonded one is to a community.
Indeed. Indeed. In fact, that's one of our encouragements to children and adolescents following Katrina, is to connect with family, connect with community, friends, connect with churches, synagogues, etc., to the extent possible. There's something about that whole notion of community that seems to enhance one's resilience, if you will. So again, tying into community has been found to be quite effective.
So the image that comes to my mind as you're talking about that is, a fireman carrying a child out of a burning building.
Yes.
And I think that that embodies what you're talking about. The community has to take the child into its arms and protect it.
Very good. Yeah, I like that. That's very good. Now, related to that is coping. That is what an individual does to deal with the traumatic event. And in our research, and a lot of other investigators have also looked at this, there are two types of coping that have differential predictive utility, if you will.
What does that mean?
They lead to different outcomes.
Okay.
There's active coping and there's avoidance coping. Let me deal with the most serious, if I will, the most negative. And this is avoidant coping. And this is where an individual is reluctant to talk about the event. They avoid people, places, and things that remind them of the event. That type of coping has been found to be highly correlated, or at least correlated, with a number of negative consequences, such as elevated symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, other anxiety disorders, physical complaints, etc. So we know that those individuals who experience negative events and don't talk about it, nor seek out help, typically do less well than those that seek treatment.
Now, I would add to this, but you tell me, I would add to that people who avoid cues of the event. So maybe the child or the adult doesn't want to be exposed to anything, like don't want to see a fireman's helmet, or they don't want to see fire on TV. If they avoid any and all cues that remind them of it, they may be more vulnerable. And it reminds me of desensitization,
yes,
which we use in people who have, say, simple phobias of fear of heights, right? We can desensitize them by exposing them slowly,
right,
to the stimulus, but giving them some form of control, like a relaxation response. And I'm wondering, do you use that in children? Do you use some kind of a control mechanism? Do you give them a control mechanism and then expose them to the trauma?
Yes. In fact, what we try and do is to, first of all, have children recount the experience in a comfortable, non-threatening environment, to just kind of tell us a little bit about what happened and their perception of why it happened, and also kind of walk through with the child the reality of what took place. Many times children will tell us, in fires, for example, that it was their fault. They knew they were going to die. There was nothing they could do, on and on and on. And what we will try and do with that child is to validate their feelings, that these are very real feelings. We'll try and normalize the feelings. But at the same time, we will try and help the child or the adolescent to kind of reprocess the event, that just because it happened doesn't mean that it was their fault, doesn't mean that the world is an unsafe place, doesn't mean that it's going to happen again. So just some cognitive restructuring, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once that's done...
I'm going to interrupt you, sure, for a second. This is Dr. Robert Hedaya on the Whole Psychiatry Hour at WMET 1160. We'll be back with Dr. Jones talking about treatment for trauma.
WMET, Washington.
The following is an urgent message for all inventors. Who cashed in on your last great idea? Do you have another invention? Do you need a patent? Then you need InventTech.
Everyone laughed at my pot that cooked and drained pasta. If I had the patent, I'd be rich.
Snap your fingers. Turn on the light. That was my idea, but I never thought to get a patent.
Don't let this happen to you. You may have a great idea, but unless you protect it, anyone can take it and keep the profits. That's why you need to call InventTech now. We'll send you a free inventor's kit, and you'll receive our free video or DVD with your confidential submission. Call 1-800-326-5757.
Cleaning with citrus was my little secret. I never patented it. Boy, was that dumb.
Don't let someone else cash in on your great idea. Call Inventec now for a free inventor's kit. Call 1-800-326-5757. Call 1-800-326-5757.
Attention men and women suffering from hair loss. Now, with Avacor, a world leader in hair regrowth, you don't have to be bald, even if you have a family history of hair loss. Here's Dr. Mark Goodman, board-certified dermatologist.
The main reason for thinning hair and baldness is hereditary hair loss. Just because there is a family history of hair loss doesn't mean you have to suffer. Avacor is specially formulated to reverse hereditary hair loss and regrow new healthy hair. Our formula targets the hair follicle to effectively stop hair loss and stimulate new hair growth. Before you consider expensive transplant surgery, remember, Avacor is FDA approved to regrow new healthy hair for men and women.
We're giving away a free month of Avacor with all of today's orders. Call 800-449-8917. That's 800-449-8917. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. Call 800-449-8917. That's 800-449-8917.
Every day, the chances of becoming a victim of mercury poisoning increase. Mercury poisoning may cause neurological damage that impairs learning, vision, and memory. And mercury itself has become part of our everyday lives, absorbed by certain fish, taken into our bodies, and passed on to our children like a common cold. But you can stop this. Log on to earthshare.org and find out how. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Tune in. Log on. Stay connected from anywhere in the world. Talk Radio WMET 1160. Your station for talk is online at WMET1160.com. Get caught up on the latest news. Check out the program schedule. Post your comments to the WMET blog. And whether you're sitting in the office or you're on the road on business, you can listen live to Greaseman, Tony Snow, J.D. Ballard, G. Gordon Liddy, Linda Chavez, and Bauer and Rose. It's all online at WMET1160.com.
Let's get back to the Whole Psychiatry Hour on WMET 1160. Here is your host, Dr. Bob Hedaya.
Welcome back to the Whole Psychiatry Hour, WMET 1160 AM. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Hedaya. Reminder, you can reach me at www.whole.com if you have questions or comments. The other thing I'd like to remind you, or actually let you know, that Dr. Jones and I will be offering a free conference call for those of you who would like to talk with Dr. Jones and myself regarding this concept of trauma, perhaps someone you know or care about and you'd like to know more about it, or just something you are curious about. Call my office at 301-657-4749. That's 657-4749. We're going to set up a free teleconference call for people who are interested. Now, Dr. Jones, let's get back to where we were. We were talking about the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and we didn't cover all of them. You wanted to mention a couple of other factors.
Yes. Two other sets of symptoms, in addition to the re-experiencing symptoms, are avoidant or numbing of responsiveness. And here we're talking about individuals wanting to avoid reminders of the event. They could be people, places, or situations trigger certain responses. Now, obviously what happens, well, maybe not so obviously what happens, when there are triggers of the event, it often brings about the negative thoughts of what took place, and those thoughts are then paired with negative emotions, and that then leads to different types of behavior. Fearful behavior, typically maladaptive behavior. So again, people engage in avoidance behavior. There are some individuals who actually are numbed following a traumatic event, such as feeling flat, like you're trying to avoid having any feelings at all.
Or you don't care about anything.
Yeah, exactly. Or feeling distant from friends and family, feeling different from other people. That also occurs on the part of many individuals who experience traumatic events. And then the third set of symptoms, or clusters, if you will, is hyperarousal. And here we're talking about individuals feeling irritable or on edge for most of the time. That is, being impatient, angry, feeling touchy, related symptom is they find it difficult to pay attention, difficulty in school, concentrating on homework, etc. And this is real important for children in that, or quite negative in that many children who experience traumatic events are at risk for doing poorly in school. Now, not all children do poorly in school following events. We did talk about those vulnerability and those risk factors, but there are some children who do have difficulty, and that may be a function of an inability to concentrate, an inability to pay attention, and or being preoccupied with the aversive stimulus.
Yeah, one of the things that happens, I believe, is that the child is in a fear state or a hypervigilant state.
Indeed.
And the primitive brain is so on alert,
yeah,
really, and the thinking brain, the prefrontal cortex, where you do your thinking and your judging and your concentration, your planning, etc., that part of the brain actually shuts down.
Indeed.
And so that's why these kids may have difficulty and in school and are certainly at risk for having difficulty and falling behind and whatnot. We were talking, Dr. Jones, about two types of coping, and one was avoidant, and we discussed that. There was another type of coping. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The other type is active coping, and this is where the individual becomes actively involved in the recovery process. So with our children who experience residential fire, for example, we try and get them to help rebuild. So, for example, a child, when it's safe, might actually assist a parent or parents removing old clothing from the home. They may help in, you know, maybe even banging a few nails in the, you know, the rebuilding of the house.
Let me ask you this. Would it be good for a child who was exposed to fire at a suitable point to, shadow a fireman?
That might not be a bad idea. I kind of qualify that because, of course, we would not want the child to be re-traumatized. So depending upon what, you know, the firefighter did and the situation would kind of dictate what to do there. But we do know for sure that children who learn evacuation skills, emergency dialing, etc., those children tend to feel more confident and in more control than children that don't. Now, we don't have data to actually support that, but there are other data that would certainly support that notion that children who actually demonstrate behaviors or are able to engage in certain behaviors have higher levels of self-efficacy and therefore typically do better in those types of situations. So again, having a child actively participate in the recovery process. Now, related to that, children who may not be involved in the process but simply hear about it, for example, following 9/11, children were encouraged to write letters, to send money, lemonade stands, and that kind of thing. When children do that, we have a sense that children have they feel better about themselves. They have a greater sense of control. They have a sense of being able to help in a difficult situation that makes them feel better. So something about helping
efficacy
on the part of children.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Rehearsal Plus.
Yes, Rehearsal Plus is a strategy that was devised in our lab here at Virginia Tech, where we teach children to not only cognitively embrace the situation, that is to talk about it, to talk about their thoughts associated with the event, to work on changing those thoughts, and in addition to actually learning certain behaviors, learning the evacuation skills, learning stop, drop, and roll, for example, coming up with an emergency plan and practicing that plan consistently over time. We found that strategy, Rehearsal Plus, has in fact been quite beneficial in enhancing children's skills as well as their positive cognitions in traumatic situations or following traumatic situations.
We're talking with Dr. Russell T. Jones about childhood trauma on WMET 1160. Dr. Jones, what is stop, drop, and roll?
Stop, drop, and roll is simply teaching a child if they incur a fire, if their clothes are on fire, that they should stop, not run, they should drop to the floor, and they should actually roll. And that was a strategy that I believe was actually coined by the National Fire Protection Association.
Is any of this taught in schools?
Yes, it is taught in schools. However, it's not taught enough. It's typically taught once a year, and that's typically, at least schools that I'm familiar with, is doing Fire Safety Week, and I think that's a great thing to do. But what's really important is that children and families need to practice those skills, and they need to actually practice the plan, getting out of the home consistently. Our research has shown that children who practice it over time typically do better than those that don't.
What would you suggest to a family, mother, father, who are listening? What kind of program should they set up? It's a busy world today. Parents are very busy. How can they do this efficiently?
Yeah, it could be something as simplistic as telling the children to, you know, if in fact there is a fire, to stay low. If they go to a door, to touch the door, feel the door with the back of the hand. If it's hot, don't go out of that door, but go to a nearby window.
Now, I'm going to interrupt. If I'm a parent, I'm thinking, well, I don't even want to bring this up to my child. I don't want to let them think a fire could happen here. My child might have nightmares.
Indeed. Indeed. In fact, many parents say that, and that's unfortunate because, you know, we know that that children should know, you know, that I think this is important. I think it's okay for children to learn to live with fear, but for children to live in fear can be devastating, can have very untoward consequences. So I think it's important that parents make children aware that we do live in a world where negative things do happen. Hurricanes happen, fires happen, floods happen, you know, shootings happen.
So we can hide, really.
That's exactly
we
right.
We can hide.
And I think the message is that we need to prepare our children to deal with those kind of situations if, you know, in the event they occur.
I think the other thing that strikes me is the importance of community. You know, we really, really have to work on getting our kids and ourselves connected to community. I want to move on. We have a limited amount of time left. We're talking with Dr. Russell Jones about childhood trauma. Dr. Jones, what could you outline, aside from the things we've talked about, are there other factors involved in treatment?
Yes, there are a number of good treatments that are out there. In fact, we call them empirically validated treatments that have been shown to lessen levels of distress as well as symptoms following a variety of traumatic events. And typically we're talking about exposure, gradually re-exposing the individual to stimuli related to the event, as well as teaching skills, how to deal with the situation if it should occur again.
What role would you say medication plays?
Well, many treatments have shown that the combination of cognitive behavioral strategies as well as medication in instances do better than either of those alone.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Jones. That's it for today's Whole Psychiatry Hour on WMET, 1160 AM. Remember, what we discussed during this hour is for educational purposes only. If you decide to take your health into your own hands, that is great. We're encouraging that. Just make sure you work with a qualified professional, someone you trust. Remember, your health care must be tailored to your body, your mind, your life, your own circumstances. Hope you've learned something today, and we look forward to talking with you next week about EMDR, a certain type of therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. This is Dr. Robert Hedaya on the Whole Psychiatry Hour.
Medical advice, opinions, and the references cited are for information only and are not intended to diagnose or prescribe. For your specific diagnosis and treatment, consult your personal doctor or healthcare provider.